Thank you, Melinda. Hi, I'm Terry Williamson. I've been a member of Al-Anon since October the 17th of 1983, and for that this afternoon, I'm very grateful. I want to thank James in the back there. James, pay attention. I'm going to talk about you. James made the phone call in January, I think, January, and said, "Do you want to come to New Orleans?" And I said, "Who doesn't want to go to New Orleans, you know?" And thank you, and thank you, the committee, for inviting me here this weekend. Melinda was great. She was right there at the gate, and, you know, we know each other. There she is. And we went and had beignets, and Glenn taught us how to eat them. You know, don't inhale. Don't inhale. You know, we got the lessons in that, and drank enough coffee so that I got to stay up for a while last night. The speakers have been wonderful so far. I've enjoyed them, Janice and Lori and Ken, that's right, and Jenny this afternoon, and Debbie, good to see you again. Haven't seen you in a long time, and it's good to see you, and I'm looking forward to the rest of our speakers. Hospitality bag, you know, with goodies, it's been wonderful. Best hospitality room I have ever been to, by the way. Need to give yourself a hand. I need to tell you that I love alcoholics, okay? Just love you. Anybody in here alcoholic? I know there's a couple. I love you, okay? Like to hang out with you. Glad we had one along yesterday, you know. I like them. I just like them. And when I got to Al-Anon, I had a sponsor who raised me in Al-Anon on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and went to a lot of open AA meetings, and the best alcoholics are the sober alcoholics. You know, I love you. And that book tells me that I'm supposed to tell you what it used to be like and what happened and what it's like today. And I thank you for the opportunity this afternoon to take you back on that journey and on that trip to what got me here to New Orleans, Louisiana this afternoon. This is not where I thought I was going to end up. You know, Al-Anon is not one of the things that my parents put on the list for me to accomplish in my life. You know, sorry. I was raised in a non-alcoholic home. I was not around alcoholics, didn't know anything about alcoholics. I was raised in a Catholic. I understand there's a few Catholics in this town. I kind of forget that from time to time. You know, New Orleans is Catholic. I'm going, oh yeah, fish. You know, I'm supposed to eat fish. It's Good Friday. And I was raised in a nice little Catholic home in a small town up in southeastern Wisconsin. And I'm the youngest of three children. I have two brothers that are 6 and 8 years older than I am. And so, you know, growing up, there was, I don't know, that things looked better from where I was sitting for, you know, where my brothers were. I always thought things were going to get different and things were going to be more exciting, you know, when I could do what they were doing. You know, I was still driving up and down the street on my tricycle, and they were all over town on their two-wheelers, you know? I mean, that looked like more fun. I thought it was going to be better when I got to high school or when I got to college or when I got married or when I started having kids, and I thought that's when life was going to start. And as a result, I never lived in the present. You know, I don't remember any of my teachers in school. I wasn't there, you know? Things because I was looking into the future. I wasn't happy where I was because nothing was going on. Is there any wonder I like alcoholics? You know, things are going on when you're there. And I was raised in this little town, and I didn't like the town, and I never felt like I fit in. My parents were married 40 years before my father passed away. They had a good marriage. I'd never heard arguments and fighting and screaming, and you know, things were really okay. things were okay. But I didn't feel like I fit in. You know, I always seemed like I was happier or more sad or more whatever when the rest of my family was just kind of okay. And I didn't understand that. And, you know, growing up, did anybody else like to watch Rock Hudson Doris Day movies? Did you like that? I saw two ladies yesterday that looked like Doris, okay? They had the suits, the little pink suits, and the quarter walking around. And anyway, I liked it. You know, I liked how Doris looked. She had the matching, you know, clothes, the outfit, the hat, the gloves. You know, she always looked good, looked put together. And she and Rock Hudson were falling in love, and I think it was over cocktails. You know, and I'm sure it was the right kind of drink and the right kind of glass. And I thought, that's what life's going to be about. You know, I don't know where I came up with that idea, but I thought that was what life was all about. You know, and as I grew up, things just never seemed to work out like I thought they should. You know, even Rock Hudson never, you know, even he didn't turn out to be what I thought he was. So, disappointed again. And, you know, growing up in that town, I really just wanted to do one thing, and that was just get old enough to fall in love, because I thought that was going to be how it was, you know, and get married and have kids. And I really didn't plan for anything else in my life. I grew up watching a lot of television in the 60s. I watched the war in Vietnam every night on the news. I watched the racial discord. I watched all the things going on in our country, and I came to the decision that God was busy. You know, God was very busy. And that really what I needed to do was to get myself together and get all my my talents and my abilities and get out there and take care of myself, because God was tied up with the rest of you. You know, and I didn't need to bother God anymore with my stuff. And so that's what I did. And I don't think I heard that in the Catholic Church. That was something that I kind of came up with myself, and I thought it was a great idea. I finished going through 12 years of parochial school, and followed all the rules. You know, at that time, you know, if you notice, they keep changing the rules. You know, when I was growing up, you couldn't eat meat on any Friday, not just Good Friday or during Lent, and so I followed those rules. You know, then later they changed that. You know, they keep changing the rules. It's no wonder that I was confused. Didn't know which way I was supposed to go. So I'm finishing high school, and I haven't found him yet. You know, he hadn't come along. I didn't have a date till my girlfriend fixed me up when I was a senior. And so, because I couldn't quite get married yet, I decided, well, I'll go away to school. And I grew up in a little town about 30 miles from Milwaukee. So I decided to go to school in Milwaukee. And Milwaukee, even though it was only about 30 miles away, was just a whole another world, you know. And I decided that I was going to be different. And I was going to be who I wanted to be, and I was going to reinvent myself, if you will. And that's what I did. And the state of Wisconsin was very generous the year that I turned 18 and decided that if you were 18, you were old enough to drink. And that suited me fine, because I still had in my mind this vision of that romance, and that, you know, you're going to fall in love with him and ride off into the sunset. I didn't grow up around alcohol. You know, I don't know where this all came from. The only alcohol when I was growing up was served at holiday time. And my mother would put out the white tablecloth and the nice china and the wine glasses, and there would be a little glass of wine. And I remember sometime around the age of 8 or 9, they kept the wine in the cupboard in the dining room. And I remember walking into the kitchen while Mom was getting the dinner ready, and she and my dad were talking about this wine. you know. They couldn't remember if they had opened it during the last holiday or if it was older than that. And there was some confusion and a little concern whether to serve it because, you know, if it was too old, did it turn into wine vinegar? And that wouldn't be good, and they didn't want to try it, you know. So I know today that they weren't alcoholic, you know. That's not been my experience with alcoholics. It wouldn't have sat there that long, nor would they have hesitated to try it, you know. So here I am, 18, and I'm living in Milwaukee, and you know, I can go recreate my Doris Day movie. The only problem is, you know, I'm 18 and I don't have any money, and Milwaukee's a beer town, so you drink beer, you know, which isn't as romantic, but you know, it'll do. I finally get myself a boyfriend, and it always has taken me a long time to get a boyfriend, but you know, when I get him, it's okay for just a little while, but then we don't quit. You know, I've never been able to quit. And a couple years go by, and it's not okay very quickly into it, but we don't know how to quit. So I'm going to school, and, you know, we have the beer parties on the weekends, and I've got this boyfriend, and finally, after a couple years, it goes to pot long enough and hard enough that it's over. So then I get another one. And the next one's worse than the first one. You know, don't know how I picked that. And the next one was someone I had nothing in common with. He was not from this country. He was from Saudi Arabia. Okay, you know, we have nothing in common. We have no religious, social, economic, anything. Nothing's in common. Okay. And I learned in that relationship how to take a lot of verbal abuse. And I didn't learn that in my home. But as we were together, he was extremely jealous, and he would accuse me of a lot of things. And even though I hadn't done those things, I knew it was my fault. I knew it. I knew it was my fault because obviously I wasn't doing something right, or he wouldn't be behaving this way. You know, and so we would get together, and we would have this big scene, and we would fight, and we'd break up, and then the phone calls would start, and we'd cry, and we'd, you know, get back together, and we did it over and over and over, and I'm doing that, and I'm working, and I'm going to school, and I keep going to school because if I get the right job, you know, then life will be okay. If I can get this relationship worked out, it'll be okay. If I can get all my things lined up and everything in the right place, then it'll be okay. Finally, he graduated from college and got sent back to Saudi Arabia, where I may still have been in Milwaukee right now, breaking up. You know, I didn't know how to stop it. Well, about this time, I decide that I've probably been drinking too much. You know, that was, you know, everybody I knew drank, and you know, but 22, 23, don't want to do these weekend parties anymore. You know, I've lost my car a couple times. And what I've learned today is that if you put enough alcohol into anybody, you'll get drunk. You know, and I'd been getting drunk, and I thought this isn't any good, so I'll just have two. And that's what I did. When I got to Al-Anon and started going to open AA meetings, and I heard AA speakers talk about their drinking, and I remembered that period in my life when I was doing a lot of drinking. And I thought, well, maybe I need to go to AA, you know. And so I cornered this woman in AA, and I said, let me tell you, I did some of those things. And she said, well, how did you stop? I said, well, I got up one day and decided I wasn't going to do that anymore. And she got a funny look on her face, and she said, "No." She said, "What did you do?" I said, "Well, maybe you didn't hear me the first time. I got up this day, and I decided, you know, I wasn't going to do that anymore, and that I would just have two." And one of our speakers described that phenomenon of craving very well this weekend, and that's what was lacking, you know. I got up one morning and decided I'd have two, and I finally came to understand that, you know, I'm not alcoholic. So here I am. I decide I'm not going to do that anymore, and just about that time, he came. You know, he came along, and you know who he is, don't you? He is my Prince Charming on a white horse. He is Mom homemade apple pie and ice cream and everything that I have always wanted. You know, and let me tell you how sweet he was. I had never been with anybody this nice and this sweet. I don't like beer, okay, even though it's a big beer town, because beer fills you up. And it makes you burp, okay? And that's not good on a date or any other time. I just really don't like beer. And so I always had a hard time, you know, getting the beer down. And so it would always get warm. But you know what he did for me? It was sweet. I bet you know Sue, don't you? You're reading ahead. He would drink his beer and he'd say, "Honey, let me finish yours so we can have a couple fresh cold ones." And I said, "This is my kind of guy." You know, nobody been that thoughtful. And that year, it was a terrible winter in Milwaukee. And we had over 30 days below zero weather. I don't like the cold weather. I don't like ice skating, snowmobiling, skiing. I don't like the cold, okay? And so we decided to take a little break, a little spring break, and go to Cape Girardeau, Missouri. So we get in the car and with our winter coats and drive 500 miles down into Missouri, and we get out on the banks of the Mississippi River, and it's spring. You know, and it's great, and the trees are blooming, and the flowers are blooming, the air is sweet, and we decide we've come to paradise. And by the way, you know, things weren't working out for him too well back in Milwaukee. He was in school, and he had a lot of plans, and he had a lot of potential, and you know, but some of those classes he was taking, the professors really... It was kind of a waste. He really needed to drop those, okay? And his job that he had, you know, his boss was just using him, okay? And he wasn't getting paid what he was worth. And I understood that, don't you? And we decided, you know, we need to leave Milwaukee. And we need to move to Cape Girardeau, Missouri. And so we drive back home, and I decide I'm going to tell my folks that I'm moving to Cape Girardeau with him. And, oh, by the way, we're going to live together, you know. I don't know why my mother was upset about that. I was trying to do the responsible thing. You know, I'm a good Catholic girl. You don't want me to get married and then divorced. You know, you need to live together first and make sure it's going to work. And then after about a year, you'll know, and then you can get married. And there's no reason to discuss the time frame with him, because when you're in love, you're just like this. You know, you're together, and you don't have to discuss details or plans. You just know how it's going to be. And he understands you, and you understand him, and it'll be perfect. So we throw the stuff in the U-Haul and we go, and we settle in. And about 5 years later, I woke up one morning and I thought, you know, I think it's time to get married. You know, that year had gone by and four more, and I thought, you know, we really need to do this or forget it. But you know, I don't issue ultimatums. Don't want to do that. So I just thought I would give him the choice. It wasn't an ultimatum, it was just a choice. and he chose, of course, that he wanted to get married. So even though I had kind of gotten away from the Catholic Church, I decided we were going to do this right. You know, he had been raised Catholic. So I went ahead and joined the church. They give you classes now to make sure that it's going to work. And so we took our class, and they said we were perfect for each other. I could have told them that. It could have saved us all a lot of time. And so we planned the wedding. We were having the wedding back in Wisconsin. It was beautiful. It was on Halloween. I got the trick. Doris would have loved it. It was a champagne breakfast. Is anything any more lovely than that? It was great. I knew that my life was okay now. You know, here I am. I've got the champagne breakfast. I've got the husband. We're going to, you know, I was getting ready when we get back home. I was going to get the wood for the picket fence. You know, the paint was on my budget. Things were going to happen. You know, we were going to wait about a year, and then we were going to start having those kids. We don't need to tell him, you know, about the time frame on that either, because, you know, I knew he understood that. And we moved back, and we set up, you know, with our wedding presents, and I'm happy. You know, he even goes to church with me a couple of weeks in a row, and I'm thinking, this is great. This is perfect. You know, it's going to be wonderful. And my life has started. And there was only one little problem. The whole time, those 5 years that we'd been together, I'd been working an evening shift, okay, which is a 3 to 11 at night. He was working during the day. Well, we had a long break, let me tell you. You know, I'd be in bed late, and he'd get up early in the morning, and I'd be in bed, and then I'd get up, and he'd be gone, and I'd leave, and he'd come home, and I'd come home, and he'd be in bed. And it was great, you know. And I might have made one mistake. I changed jobs because I felt like now that we were getting married, I needed to have Monday through Friday daytime job like he did. And so I did that. We're gonna do this right, okay. And then there's a holiday right after Halloween. It's called Thanksgiving. And so I'm ready. You know, I have the white tablecloth on. I have the new wedding dishes and crystal on the table. And I have cooked Thanksgiving dinner. And it's going to be just like the movies. We're going to live happily ever after. And he came to the table for Thanksgiving dinner, and he was drunk. And I knew I had made a mistake. I knew I had made a mistake. You see, he could stay sober 1 or 2 days a week when I was off those days. But it was impossible for him to stay sober 7 nights a week. I knew when I met him that he drank on a daily basis. And it started out with a six-pack every couple of days, and we were buying it several cases a week now because it was cheaper. And I understood that. When he explained to me, I always look for a bargain. Yesterday, you saw I was looking for bargains in the antique stores. And so I understood that, you know. And I never thought that there was anything wrong. You see, I'm a nurse. My profession is nursing, and I know what alcoholics look like. And alcoholics come in the hospital, and they have cirrhosis of the liver, and they're yellow. And they go into DTs, and you put them in restraints, and they die. And that's what alcoholics are. And I was not married to an alcoholic. Before that wedding, we had made a trip to the emergency room of the hospital because he thought he was having a heart attack. He was having a lot of chest pain. And when I saw him sitting on the cot behind the drapes when they finally let me in, he was crying, and he told me he was an alcoholic. I said, no, you're not. You know, you're not. We know your father's an alcoholic, but you're not. And just quit drinking that much and it'll be fine. You know, my God, we have the wedding planned. And not going to marry one of those. And I never even remembered that until I'd been in Al-Anon almost 2 years, that we had ever had that conversation, because I was not going to marry an alcoholic. And that Thanksgiving, sitting at that table and looking across that turkey, I realized I'd married an alcoholic. And I realized that God was punishing me for everything that I had ever done, for everything I had not done in my life. And that He had waited until it was too late. You know, I'm married, it's too late for me to do anything about this relationship. And now God was going to punish me for the rest of my life. And I told no one what I found out that day. I decided to kind of close the door on that topic. And then I knew I was going to have to live with it. And I went to work on Monday, and when they said, "How is everything, Terry?" I smiled and I said, "It's great. You know, I am not going to admit that I have made a mistake. I don't even have the proofs back from the pictures, the wedding. I don't have thank you notes written, and I am not going to admit to my mother that she was right." That was in November, and by March, I read Ann Landers. Does anybody read Ann Landers? Ann Landers talks about Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And he came home from work, and for some reason, I told him that he was an alcoholic and he needed to go to AA. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, except that that's where he needed to go. And I don't know why he went along with it, but he did. And I had already called. I had already looked up in the Yellow Pages. I had made the phone call. I knew where the meeting was. I had it all scoped out. They told me there was something called Al-Anon, and I found out it was at the same time in the same place. And so I went to Al-Anon to make damn sure that he went to AA and stayed in that meeting. And the ladies there were very sweet. You're very nice. You seem to be getting along very well. This Al-Anon thing seemed to be helping you, and I was glad for you. But, you know, at 9 o'clock, I wanted to make sure he had been in that room. And we went for 3 meetings that week. We went Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and on Saturday he had a car wreck and was in the hospital. And he was in the hospital for a couple of weeks. And when he got out, we never talked about it again, and I never saw him take another drink. And I thought that I was losing my mind. You see, he had been to AA, and he knew he couldn't drink. And there was something wrong with me because, you know, I would have these conversations with myself. I'd say, "Terry, I don't know what's wrong with you. You're paranoid. You know, he's not drinking. You know he's not drinking. You know, there's nothing in the refrigerator anymore. He's been to AA, but he was acting funny." You know that? How they act? They act funny. He was acting funny. And he acted funny for several months until I came home from work one night and I saw the bottle of beer slip behind my chair. And then I knew why he was acting funny. And we never talked about it. We never talked about it. And I would get up in the morning and I would shut the door in that house and I would go to work and everything would be fine. And I couldn't wait to get home at night and I would have to make, you know, I'd have to make dinner. I don't know why we have to feed them, but I really needed to feed them. And I would hurry, and cook something real fast. And get it on the table, and he never stayed out. You know, we always want what we don't have. Isn't that something? You know, I hear women complaining, you know, "Oh, I stayed at the window waiting for him. I wish he had left. You know, I wish I..." But he was always there. And he would come home, and I had a good night, if I could get him fed and in his chair before he passed out. Because I'd finally realized that that's what he was doing. You know, for years I just thought he was a heavy sleeper. And I could get him in his chair and before he passed out. And then I could settle down for the night. I could get the dishes washed. I could get in my chair with him in his chair, and the TV's over here. And I could do my needlework. You know, we'd love to do that needlework. Do my needlework and keep an eye on him and watch TV. He never did anything, but you never know. And, you know, and about 10 o'clock, I'd get ready for bed and I'd go to bed. And I'd be in bed, and then I'd hear him, you know, come to. And then I would lay in bed, and I would hear the cans open in the next room. And I would cry, and I would say, God, why are you doing this to me? And then I would pull myself together, and I'd wait, and my heart would be pounding, and I knew when the next one would go off because it was, you know, it was timed. And then I would cry, and I'd say, God, why are you doing this? And we would do that most of the night before I could finally fall asleep. And then I'd get up the next day, and I'd try to put on some kind of makeup and get out of that house and shut the door on that and go to work, and everything was fine. And I did it day after day and week after week. And I told no one. You know, our families lived 500 miles away, and when they'd call, everything was fine. We had no friends, and no one walked into that house. And I thought it was our secret. If you want to get sick, go ahead and do it like that. I wanted to die. I didn't want to kill him, but I wanted to die. I thought when I got here I wasn't an angry person, and yet, you know, when I say I didn't want him to die, I did want to inflict pain. And he had bad knees, and when he would be passed out at night, I used to think, if I just had a baseball bat, you know, a few good crunches across those knees, he'd never walk again. You know, I was tired of hearing about those knees. I thought I'd give you something to complain about. You know, but the truth was I was too scared. You know, the truth was I was too scared. The truth was, you know, he had an arsenal in the back bedroom. You know, the truth was that was God taking care of me. I remember the night that I found him in a blackout at the top of the basement stairs. And he was kind of weaving, and I thought, there's nobody here. They'll never know that it wasn't an accident. You know, and one little flick, and we can check on them in the morning. You know, call the ambulance, call the undertaker. It didn't make any difference. You know, and instead I pulled him back into the kitchen. You know, but for the grace of God, I don't know where I would be today. I did not want to see a psychiatrist, even though by this time I had laid out the knives on the kitchen counter and couldn't decide which knife to use on myself, and I was too afraid that he might come to and he might call an ambulance before I was dead. And if they took me in, I didn't know if I would ever get out of that psychiatric unit. I knew there was something wrong with me. I knew you don't plan your suicide. I knew you didn't live like this and that you were okay, but I was too scared to see anybody because I was afraid they'd put me in one of those nut houses. You know, I had been in those when I was in nursing school, and the people that are in there, they have the armbands, and other people have the keys, you know. And I knew I wouldn't be having that key. And I was terrified that I would never get out. I called Al-Anon at one point, and they were still there, but I couldn't go back. And I didn't go back until that evening in October, and I got home from work, and I looked in the mirror, and I said, I can't do this. Cannot do this. I remember the day because it was 2 weeks before our second wedding anniversary. And I couldn't do it for 30 years, you know. I looked at his mother and his father, and they'd been doing it for 35 years, and I knew I couldn't last that long. And that night was not any different than any of the other nights that had been going on for a long time. But I got in the car, and I drove downtown. And the group was in an old building on the Mississippi River, upstairs. You know, by this time I can't breathe. I hyperventilate a lot. I have chest pain a lot. I have blackouts between my visits. I'm a visiting nurse, and I have clinics, and I can't remember how I get from one house to the next, and I have to leave the clinic because I have to go to the bathroom because I can't breathe. And so I have to climb these stairs, and I almost couldn't get to the top. And when I got to the top, the Al-Anon room was right there, and all I could do was sit in the first chair. You know, and it was an old building, and it had old folding tables and had folding chairs around it. And there was one folding chair right by the door. You know, and I remember looking in the mirror before I went to that meeting, wondering if they would know. You know, I don't know why I thought they were there, but, you know, I didn't know if it was going to show. There was something wrong, and I didn't want it to show. And I walked in, and I sat down in that chair, and people were talking, you know, how we talk before meetings, and just trying to breathe. And all of a sudden, there's a woman sitting next to me. She had her back to me at first, and she spun around in that chair. And her face probably wasn't that close, but it felt like her nose was almost touching mine, and she was smiling from ear to ear, you know. And she had makeup on, and she had, you know, kind of nice clothes, and she looked happy. And she was just kind of beaming, and she said hi, and she said her name, and she scared me to death, you know, absolutely scared me to death. She said later on that she was living with an alcoholic, but I doubted it, you know. She looked much too put together for that. And they opened that meeting, and they read the steps. I didn't know what that was they were reading, because I really don't remember anything except I remember somebody reading that first step. It said we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. And I said, that's it. I understood that first step. See, I was powerless over my life. I was powerless over what was going on in that house. I was powerless over what was going on anymore when I left that house. I was no longer able to shut the door on it when I left. And my life had become a nightmare. And the next thing I remember is that everybody was gone. I guess the meeting was over. And I was sobbing in that room to that woman who had said hello to me. And she made me a promise that night. You know, they don't make many promises to you here in this place. But she promised that if I would come back, and if I would do whatever this Al-Anon thing was, that I would be okay. And it's a promise that came true. You know, she didn't promise me the picket fence. She didn't promise me 2.5 kids. She didn't promise me that he was going to get sober, that we were going to be great, that it was going to be fine. She promised me that I was going to be okay. And I believed her. And I don't know why. But I believed her. That group had three meetings a week. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, they had Al-Anon meetings. And I started coming Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And there must have been some kind of talk about a sponsor, because I didn't come up with the term myself, obviously. And I asked her, this lady that I had spoken with, to be my sponsor, and I didn't know what that was or what we were going to do, okay? But all I knew is she looked pretty good. Okay, she looked pretty happy. and I wanted what she had. And so she told me that I was going to have to call her every day, and I was going to have to read this little book called One Day at a Time, and I thought, excuse me, I don't think I have time. Okay? You don't understand how tired I am. And now you want me to get up early and call you, and I don't know if I have time to read this book, and, you know, this is what I'm thinking. But I said, okay, you know, because that was the condition. She would sponsor me if I would do these things. And so we started to do these things. She sent me to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous to find out about these steps. You know, she said, that's where it comes from. That's the original book. That's it. That's what we're going to read. She said, you don't know anything about alcoholics. You don't know anything about alcoholism. And that's how you're going to find out. And that's where we went to study those steps. And I didn't know what we were doing. I just knew that I was starting to feel better. You know, it was getting worse, but I was starting to feel better. You know, I started wanting to come to the meetings early, and I wanted to go to coffee afterwards. And I loved it. You know, I loved it. And it was okay while I was there. And then she slipped in that we were going to pray. I thought, you don't understand. God doesn't listen to me. He doesn't answer prayers. You know, it doesn't work. Doesn't work. And she told me that I didn't have to believe whether it worked or not. I just had to go do it. You know, that I had to invite God into the day. That I had to thank God at night. And at first, and for a long time, the best I could do at night was laying in bed, and I'd turn off the light, and I'd say, oh yeah, God, Susan said to say thanks. Yeah. So there you have it. You know, she told me I was supposed to get on my knees, and I don't think I told her. You know, wasn't going to do that. And I don't know about any of you, but weekends were bad. You know, Monday through Friday was pretty good. I could go to work. I had a meeting Monday, Wednesday, Friday. But weekends were bad because there were no meetings for me to go to. And you're not going to work, you know, and he's there the whole time. And I didn't like that. You know, I didn't like it. By Sunday, I was not okay by Sunday. Sundays especially were really bad because, you know, Saturday you could clean the house and go to the grocery store, but Sunday was just, boy, it was empty. And after a few months had gone by, one Sunday night I was laying in bed and I was getting ready to tell God one more time, oh yeah, God, thanks. And I realized as I was laying there that I had had a pretty good day. You know, it was a Sunday and I had had a good day. I was all right. And he was still out there in his chair, you know, and nothing had changed. Nothing had altered. But I was okay. And I hadn't done anything. And that was the first night I was willing to get out of that bed and get on my knees and thank God. It was the first time that I could believe that maybe God was doing something for me that I couldn't do for myself. And those steps started to change. And that relationship with God started to change. She was a real believer in going to conventions like this. And it was a small town, you know. She talked about it so much that you really get sick of it. You know these sponsors, how they are. You know, she didn't tell me I had to go, but she was always leaving. You know, leaving me behind. Thank you very much. And so finally I thought, oh, fine, we'll just shut her up. We'll go to one of these things, okay? And so there was a group of us, jumped in a van, and we went to Little Rock, Arkansas for my first convention. And I was in the program maybe 4 or 5 months, and I loved it. You know, I walked in, and there was this huge room. I mean, it looked like it was, I know it wasn't probably any bigger than this, but it looked just monstrous, and it was packed full of people, and of course everybody's smoking and talking, and the speakers, and they were wonderful, and I cried and I carried on. It was the most wonderful weekend of my life. Okay, and I got hooked. you know, I got hooked. And 2 months later, we went to another one. And 2 months later, we went to another one. And you know, she told me I needed to do a fourth step. And I have a theory about fourth steps. I have a theory that you're ready. You know when you're ready. You're ready when your sponsor has heard enough of your stuff. Okay? When your sponsor says it's time for you to do your fourth step, it's because she's tired of listening to it, you know? And so if you don't want to do one right away, get one that can't hear or, you know, has a lot of patience, because she didn't have a lot of patience, you know. I had to do a fourth step pretty fast. And do a fifth step and make a list and start making amends. And my life changed. You know, my life changed. I changed. You know, the stuff's still going on, but gosh, I felt good. There was a convention that summer in Crested Butte, Colorado. I'd never been to Colorado. Always wanted to see the mountains. I made plans to go. I went, and it was wonderful. I was absolutely nuts. I know that now. I thought I was doing fine. I was nuts. And I had been praying about this. You know, my sponsor gave me this prayer about this marriage. You know, I thought, what am I going to do? You know, I'm going to these conventions. I'm looking at people. You know, he's an AA. She's an Al-Anon. They look happy ever after. You know, I just know if I stay here long enough, he'll sober up. You know, and it's going to be great. I can feel it. You know, it's going to be wonderful. And so she said, well, why don't you pray about it? That was always her answer. Why don't you pray about it? Why don't you say this prayer? She said, why don't you say, God, your will be done for that relationship, as, you know, and for him as well as for yourself, and take that relationship and let it be what you want and show me the truth. And I thought, this is a piece of cake. This is the first easy assignment I've had. You know, because God's will is we're going to be happily ever after married. He's going to be sober. I'm still waiting to start those kids, you know. And if we're going to go down the road to happy destiny together, you know, I've been reading the book. It's going to be great. And so I start saying that prayer. And I'm saying the prayer, you know, week after week, day after day, month after month. He's not getting sober. And we're up there in Crested Butte, and something happened to me there. And I know today it was a spiritual experience, if you will. Because leaving that place, I got on an airplane that was late leaving. All the luggage got lost. I'm late getting into the airport. I get into the St. Louis airport at midnight. I get out to my long-term parking. I'm out there by myself. Get in the car, drive a couple hundred miles back to Cape Girardeau, and I knew everything was okay. You know, I wasn't afraid for the first time in my life. I wasn't afraid to about the luggage. I wasn't afraid about the traveling. I wasn't afraid to drive. I wasn't afraid to go home, because I knew that God was going to take care of me. And I believe today that's what I needed to know. Because about 4 weeks later, I drive with her to Hannibal, Missouri, which is a little further north. It's August on the Mississippi. You know how August is here. I don't need to tell anyone from New Orleans. It's hot, it's sticky, it's nasty. After the speakers got done talking at the anniversary that night, we're out in the parking lot there by the river with the bugs and the mosquitoes and the humidity. And we're talking, and for some reason we joined hands and we said that prayer, the three of us together, one more time, the speaker and my sponsor and myself. And when we got done with that prayer, I knew what my answer was. And my answer was that marriage was over. And that's not the answer that I expected from that prayer. That is not what I wanted to hear. But that was the truth. You know, the truth was I had been his mother. The truth was that it was my self-will run riot that caused that marriage in the first place. He never did want to marry me. And it was time to get out. So you do what any normal person does. You drive back. You wait till he's gone so you can steal your clothes. You know, he's actively drinking. You don't know what's going to happen. He's got a house full of guns. And you throw your things in the car. My sponsor is moving back to Fort Worth, Texas, where she's coming from. And she said, why don't you come with me? And I said, I believe I will. I quit my job and moved to Fort Worth, Texas with her. I said that prayer in the parking lot on Saturday, and I was in Fort Worth by Thursday. Never been to Fort Worth, Texas in my life. Okay? Never wanted to go. That, you know, it's the westerns, you know, the cowboys and the gunslingers, and I'm sure they have dirt streets and cattle drives. And, you know, I had this concept of what Texas was, and I knew, you know, logically that's not how it is, but I never wanted to go there. And I pulled into Fort Worth, Texas on Thursday night, and for the first time in my life, I knew I was right where I needed to be. I knew that that's where I was headed all my life. I knew that I had come home. My oldest brother was a little concerned. He felt like I had joined a cult. He's calling me long distance from Chicago, wanting to know what cult I had joined. He was very concerned that I had quit my job. And I felt at that time it was not necessary to share my experience on the riverfront that Saturday night with him. I felt like he might not understand. And he finally quit calling after I did get a job. I felt a little better, I think. And I settled into life, into Al-Anon in Fort Worth, and I loved it. You know, there were meetings 7 days a week. There were big meetings. There was lots of people. It was fabulous. It was fabulous. And true to form, it took a good year to get a divorce. You know, after you get one, you could never get rid of them. You know, one more time, I couldn't get rid of them. It should have been easy. It should have been simple. And of course.
This is the end of side one. Please turn cassette over now and continue to listen on side two. Do not fast forward.
Rid of them. It should have been easy. It should have been simple. And of course it wasn't. And we didn't have any money. We didn't have any kids. We didn't have anything to fight about. But boy, we could drag it on for a while. And finally got it over with. And you know, my life was good. It was very good. And I had friends, and I had fellowship, and I had a job. You know, I also liked to change jobs a lot before I got here. And I ended up with a job back in 85 that, believe it or not, I still have today, which is just unheard of that I could have the same job for 15 years. And I love it, you know. And I had friends, and somewhere along the way, I ran into a guy. Well, not somewhere along the way. He was right there, you know. He was a speaker. He was going to the same group I was going to. He had been one of the first speakers I heard back in Little Rock that first year. He was the speaker that I prayed with on the river. And he had become my friend, you know. And he was a long, tall Texan with white hair and blue eyes. And he became my best friend. And we got married. I picked another holiday, New Year's Eve of 87. And, you know, if alcoholics aren't drinking, they might as well get married on New Year's Eve, don't you think? And it was great. And God blessed us with a really great time, a great marriage. We had a lot of fun together. And, you know, life doesn't just stop, and you don't just say, kind of move into that happy, joyous, and free, and everything's okay, because life still goes on. You know, and that's not to say we weren't scared about money. And after 4 years in 91, we finally found out what his health problem was, and he had a pretty serious heart problem, and it never seemed to slow him down, you know, but it started a long trip to doctors and emergency rooms, and finally in 97 he had open heart surgery, and you know, it never really slowed him down. And
We caused quite a stir when we did get married, you know. It was rather controversial. He was a little older than I was. He didn't have that white hair at birth. But we had a good time. And I learned a lot from Jim Williams. You know, I learned a lot from him. I learned that he placed God first, and AA was second, but I got to be number three. You know, I got to be number three. And as long as he and God were fine and he was doing AA, we were great. And I didn't have to be first anymore in anybody's life. God was first. You know, he taught me what it was to live a spiritual life. And I'm grateful to him. Jim passed away January 3rd of last year. And he had not been well. And I knew that by the fall before that, that if something didn't change, that 99 would be the last year I'd have him. But I didn't expect it to be the 3rd of January. I can't tell you what a difference it made those days and those weeks having AA and Al-Anon in our home. What a difference it made to pick up the phone call and make a call and everybody was there. He had not been feeling well, and he woke up that morning and he was better. And he was chipper, and he was happy, and he was on the telephone talking to everybody, just like he always did. And he said, you know, it's awfully cold, and I haven't been feeling too well. Why don't you pick up the folks and take them to lunch, like we always did, his aunt and his uncle. And Saturday and Sunday, we always had lunch with them. And I said, okay. And he said, bring me back something to eat. And when I got back home, about an hour and a half later, I found him. And God had taken him home. And you see, I've learned something since I've been here. I've learned that God is good. That he didn't have to suffer anymore, and that he didn't have to go to the hospital anymore. And that God took him right where he loved to be. And there's a book that says, in all things, we need to give him thanks. And I got to give him thanks. Three weeks after Jim's funeral, his uncle was admitted to the hospital. And I got to plan his funeral 3 weeks after that. He was 89, and he'd been a pretty blustery, tough little guy. But I think he missed Jim too much. And then that left me with his little 91-year-old aunt, who was just precious. You know, she had fiery red hair when she was younger, and I wish I had known her then, you know, because she was quite a little pistol. And the two of them were still tooling around in their Toyota cars, you know. And she wanted to continue living in her home and by herself, and I insisted that she have somebody come in once a day to make sure everything was okay. And she stomped her foot, and I stomped mine back, and I won. And 3 months later, Ann Lee fell, and she broke her hip, and she died a week later. And in 4.5 months, I buried my family. And last year was a very difficult year. And I miss all of them. I miss all of them. You see, God gave me the family for those three people that I always wanted. I always wanted that family that you could go to Sunday dinner with. And we had Sunday dinner every week, you know, for 13 years. Unless we were out of town at a convention, or if Jim was gone, I still had dinner with him. You know, and it was sweet and it was good. And God blessed me with that. And I would have missed it if I hadn't been here with you. I would have missed it. And one more time, God has been faithful. You know, He's given me the people that I need to walk through the difficulties of life. It was about 6 months before Jim's death. There was a lady that I've known for a number of years in AA, and we went and heard her on our Friday night speaker meeting that we have in our group, and she got done talking, and I knew that's who God was sending me, because she had walked through what I knew I was going to be walking through sometime. I didn't know when, but I knew it was coming, and Donna was there for me. Donna was there when I went to the funeral home for the first time. And Donna's been there for me ever since. And then God sends you newcomers, you know, just when you need them. Just when you need them. And we didn't know why God was getting Kathy ready, but she arrived just on time. She got to experience the whole thing. She got to be my funeral buddy last year. And she came with me this weekend. And it's her first convention. Can you believe that? Great. They're clapping for you. And then a couple months after we buried Ann Lee, Kathy's daddy died. And so I got to give back to her. And that's how we do it, you know. It's a circle, and we get to give and receive here. I don't know what the rest of my life is going to be. You know, I don't know. I don't know how the next part's going to start or how it's going to turn out. But I know today that if I stay here with you, that wonderful things will happen. I know if I stay here with you, I'll get to see some of you again. I know that we're going to be able to share and to enjoy and to go through the hard times and to share the good. They say somewhere that if you have somebody to walk with through life, that your joy is doubled and your sorrow is halved. And that's what you've given me. You've given me a relationship with God that I never dreamed. You've given me a life that I never imagined. You've given me time and your love. And there's no way that I can ever repay that. And see, we don't expect payment here. And I think that's because there isn't any that's big enough or good enough. But we've got some tools, and we've got some hands to reach out to. And the book says that you'll surely meet some of us. You know, and some days we trudge, and some days we skip. You know, and I hope this weekend that we have a lot of skipping and we have a lot of laughter. You know, you've given to me a lot this weekend, and your hospitality and your love, and I appreciate that very, very much. And I thank you for coming this afternoon. Thank you for going back to that trip with me one more time. I need to remember what it used to be like. Because unless I remember, I'm doomed to repeat it. I don't want to go back. and you've given me a new way to live. And I'm grateful that you're with me as we get to live it. Thank you.